By now, you'll have heard or seen that I'm working with a new golf app called Tangent, who are also sponsoring this show. It's the smartest AI caddy in golf and is able to recommend not only clubs to hit, but target locations based on the math behind strokes gained and your own personal shot patterns. Unlike many other shot trackers, it also takes into account and adjusts for hazards that are out there. It has sensorless tracking with an amazing automatic swing detection that you can use with your Apple Watch or your phone without any need to buy any attachments for your clubs. And my favorite part, the post-round analysis data helps you immediately see where you can improve and gives you simple breakdowns that you can dive into if you want much more detail about your stats. It then links this data to recommendations and actual practice drills that you can use to improve. Getting measurable data for both on-course and practice drills makes Tangent one of the best game improvement ecosystems that I've ever seen. So download Tangent for free on the Apple App Store or at tangent.golf and use promo code SWEET30, that's SWEET30, for 30% off. So you'll get a free trial, and if you like it and want to continue, it'll give you 30% off a subscription. So just try it out, play a few rounds with it, and I know you'll love it. So that's Tangent, T-A-N-G-E-N-T, and enter code SWEET30.
Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf, and as always, I'm joined by
Adam from Adam Young Golf.
So today we are joined by our good friend Scott Fawcett from Decade Golf. I believe this is your third appearance on The Sweet Spot, but I looked at our records here, our feed more specifically, and I think you haven't been on the show in, I think it's like a year and a half if I'm doing my math correctly. So
feels about right.
Sorry for the long hiatus and welcome back.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Congrats to you on all your fun stuff this summer and always enjoy talking to you too.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to end up in like some deep rabbit hole of philosophy and
probably
nihilism or something like that. But
I'm trying to get less nihilistic. I'm really putting effort into it.
Good, Scott.
In the group, I would rank nihilistic tendencies. Adam is number one. You are number two. And I'm probably a distant number three, but I've got some. Well, anyway, we'll see what happens. But since Scott was last on the show, I know you've been playing a lot. You've put a lot more content on Decade. Tournament stuff, non-tournament stuff. And you're always a great communicator. So we'll see what comes up. And I know you had a few things you wanted to touch on. So yeah, what's been going on since you last came on?
Well, you know, just kind of like you said, I've actually been able to play a little bit more golf this year. Back in 2021 was when I had both the surgeries on my elbow. So that was just kind of an entirely lost year. The first surgery was in March and the next one was in July. So I literally didn't touch a club for like 11 months. The whole goal was to start getting the body ready to turn 50 on July 4th, like I did this summer. And, you know, I really was planning on obviously trying to get my game ready for Q School, which is in November and December for senior tour. The guys from Good and the YouTube clan, they posted it was actually a pretty cool deal they did. They just gave away $100,000. I'm obviously quite positive they probably made $1 million back. So it's not like they're the most charitable nice. Souls on the planet, but they just threw a $100,000 tournament where you had 63 guys apply for spots. And I was like, I don't play much winter golf. My skin sucks. So once I kind of hang them up in October, I pretty much don't touch my clubs until we're confident it's not going to be cold again. So I hadn't really played at all in 5 months whenever they announced this thing in March. So like, that'd be kind of fun if I, you know, get a little publicity, whatever, for Decade. And so I applied and got in. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to post a score in 4 weeks.
Now I have to play. I know that sounds familiar. Now I got to play in this thing.
It literally didn't really cross my mind. And so luckily I usually can whip my game into shape pretty quickly. And I went out there, I played pretty good. I shot 68 and missed. They had 63 guys for 12 spots, which were all like kind of half the field was decent mini tour players. And half the field was kind of like social media playing, you know, golfers, whatever you want to call them, guys like Fat Perez and whoever. So really, I mean, honestly, I was pretty happy. But
wait, did you just say Fat Perez?
Yeah, you don't know Fat Perez from Bob Does Sports?
I don't know a lot of things, but so I definitely don't really know who Fat Perez is.
You're in your silo so well.
Yeah, Adam and I are in like these, Adam's cocoon's a little deeper than mine, but I don't know a lot of things that are going on out there in the golf
I have
world.
Seen the Fat Perez title recently. What, does he change his name to that or something by default?
I mean, you know, I shouldn't comment as though I know much about it or him. But he's one of the guys that's always on, I'm pretty sure the Bob Does Sports videos the just YouTube-y stuff. And I think he's like a scratch or a plus two-ish handicap, maybe a two. I don't know. He's a solid player. I actually don't even know what he shot in the thing, though. I know he didn't make it. Actually, gosh dang it, what's the guy that always does with a Monday Q caddies for him and a couple of different tour events and stuff? I can't draw a blank on his name right now. I just sat in the sauna for 20 minutes, which was probably the worst idea to do before coming on this and get my brain nice.
You sweat out all your good ideas.
Well, my wife's getting a colonoscopy tomorrow, so I'm fasting with her in solidarity, and then I just went and sat in the steam room for 20 minutes, so I'm not going to come
good
up with
times.
Any names. Yeah.
So you played in the good. I think I actually saw a clip of like someone almost getting killed from a tee shot at that thing. That was the only thing I saw from it.
That's certainly possible. I didn't see that at all. The guy that
they had like galleries, like it was a PGA Tour event. And
no, that was the same day, but that was Garrett. That was, so they did like a good meetup. And so they did. I think that was at McCormick Ranch, maybe somewhere else in Scottsdale. And Garrett did pelt a dude right in the arm.
Ouch.
Like that was close. I mean, people don't understand why they have ropes on tour is so people, you keep on encroaching in because you want to see what's, you know, going on. And literally the kid, he probably cost himself $1 million because on the video on his phone, he's leaning out over to, and he literally says, "I don't even care if Garrett hits me right now," and then nailed him.
Oh, he called his shot.
Yeah. I think they gave him free good merch for life.
Nice. So that was your first like tournament back. And
yeah.
You played well. I mean, you shot 68. That's pretty damn good.
Shot 68. And I was, you know, it was solid, but my green reading was just horrific, which that's what, there's a few things that you've really got to play a decent amount of golf to be sharp with, and green reading is one of them. I came home, and then the following Monday, I shot 70 to miss US Open locals by one, again, with some horrendous green reading. And so that's actually, I've reached out to this guy named Ralph Bauer, who's kind of been on my butt for 2 years to teach his new, you know, it's called Tour Read Golf.
I met Ralph. Yeah, he was explaining it to me.
Dude, it's phenomenal. I mean, it really is. I've always been a big fan of Aimpoint. I've just always said I kind of suck at it. And what Ralph has been on me, like, dude, this, it's better than Aimpoint. If you think about it, if everyone has their hands calibrated correctly and have read the slope correctly, like, there's a mathematical answer to, everyone should come up with the same answer if you're doing Aimpoint. And he's just simplified it into an equation, which I'm obviously not going to give away. But it works really, really well. And one of the main things that I had never thought about was, and I was like, dude, I just really suck at guessing the slopes. And he was like, what you need to do is find the lowest, you know, we just go out there with a digital level and find the lowest slope you can perceive, which for me at the time was 1.2%. And so then you, what you'll find is you really don't see any break. It looks pretty straight if it's like 0.5 or less. And then for me, if I can start to see break, but I can't feel it yet, I know it's like 0.5 to 1-ish. Now I can feel it and see it. And then it's like just a sliding scale. And Aimpoint could have that same logic also.
Yeah, but that's also like the difference in terms of confidence, like a 0.5% versus 1%. That's just outside the cup from 10 feet or just inside right from 10 feet. So that can mess with your head if you don't know it.
Yeah. And I mean, I hit some really good putts, you know, so then I played those two events, and then I played the Texas Amateur Qualifier, shot 67, the Texas Open Qualifier, shot 67 and qualified for that. So then I had a nice little run set up for July where I turned 50 on July 4th. I was going to kick it off at Firestone with the Senior British Open Qualifier, the next week in St. Louis with my U.S. Amateur Qualifier, the next week in Tyler, Texas with the Texas Open, and then the following week in Albuquerque for the U.S. Mid-Am Qualifier. So I really had it a pretty solid little run of golf set up, and I played good. I shot 70, had 6 birdies, 6 bogeys, 6 pars in the Senior British Open Qualifier to shoot 70, just kind of some rusty mistakes. Played decent at the USAM Qualifier, and then it all kind of started to come together, just getting a few events in a row in, and I shot 64 and actually had the lead in the first round of the Texas Open, and then really played terrible the second round. It was kind of disappointing, but I shot 72. And then shot 69, 67. I mean, it was the first solid finish for a 50-year-old amateur. It was pretty funny that month of July, I played in a senior tour event, and then the U.S. amateur, and then a professional event, and then the U.S. mid-am. I am still trying to figure out what my demographic is.
Yeah. And I'm sure it was 120 degrees out on a lot of those events.
So hot. Well, then that was the one thing that was disappointing, was on the range at the State Open. I just was walking, and just all of a sudden felt this pop in my left ankle. And it literally, like, it dropped me. Like, my foot literally completely flinched and reacted. It just, I went up like a stork onto one leg and fell. It's like, that was weird. And kind of massaged it out. And then about 3 days later, it happened again. And then about 2 days later and the next day, and then I wound up only being able to play nine holes at the US Mid-Am qualifier because it was just starting to hurt. And so I haven't touched my club since August 1st in Q school.
Let's be honest. You were terrified at the prospect of facing me in the US Mid-Am because you knew I was going to light it up.
Absolutely no doubt about that.
Just the really imposing figure I am. So where are things now? I know you've got another surgery or not surgery. Like how's the body doing?
I had my seventh MRI in 2.5 years on Friday. On my left shoulder again, I had one earlier this year. I've got a torn rotator cuff, but we did three PRP shots in it and it was good for a while. And now I've got it to where I'm an idiot. Again, I've recognized I need to grow up and stop trying to do certain things, but I was like, well, I can't really play for the next 2 months. So I'm going to try to get really strong. I've got a couple months to work on that. So I went a little excessive and now anytime I do anything upper body, my shoulder feels like it's going to explode. So we're going to try a cortisone shot in it now. Again, I haven't gotten the results back from the MRI to see if I've torn it more. The rehab from it's a few months anyway. So even if I do the surgery, I can't play in Champions Tour Q School. And if I don't do the surgery, I might as well try. So I'm kind of in that spot. But this is what's interesting. This is one of the things I wanted to talk about was I've always been a guy that on chip shots, I really can whip my game into shape pretty good. My golf swing's pretty solid. It just doesn't change much. Since I know to focus almost exclusively on my speed control and putting, I don't waste my time, practicing other stuff with putting very much because speed control, you can really whip in shape pretty quickly. But my short game has always just been this kind of asterisk of, it's kind of like reading greens. You got to hit a lot of chip shots in order to be good at it. And when I went out for that good tournament in April, that was in Scottsdale, I went down to see Mr. Golf Better Tucson, Derek Dominski, down in Tucson. Just because I'm like, well, this guy's obviously a great short game teacher. And so I'm hitting a few shots and he's like, I actually like your motion. There's really not a whole lot I have to say about it. So just carry a shot 7 yards for me. And I'm like, well, can you show me a hole? And he's like, no, just carry one 7 yards. And I'm like, I don't really have a frame of reference for that. I chipped to the hole. And he's like, oh, he said this so matter of factly, you have to have a shot. You carry 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, and 15 yards. Those numbers just come up all the time. And it was just like, what are you, an idiot? You don't know that? But this is what's crazy, man. So I literally, for the next 6 weeks, did not hit a chip shot to a hole. I would literally I've got these Nike discs that I would just lay out on the side of the range at just 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30. And then obviously I had the 7.5, the 2.5 increments in between.
So kind of like a ladder drill that you would do with putting.
And all I was doing was just trying to carry it onto those. And this is where, I'm a 50-year-old pretty good golfer. I can pretty much see the shot that needs to happen. I've just never thought about exclusively trying to land it on a spot. Well, now I know that if I barely move my hands, that's a 5-yard carry. And it's a feel that I've got with barely moving my hands with what I feel like a little bit of travel with my wrist, that's 7, a little more. And I've got these 2.5-yard increments. And so I actually did a video with Ben Haddon, one of the good guys, a couple weeks ago. It's 4 practice tips. I'm sure if you search Ben Haddon
golf. I actually did. I looked at before we started talking. I did see some of that. It looked good.
Well, this is where the people who are watching will be able to see what I'm talking about now. So if I get
– no one's watching. We don't do video. We're in the dark ages.
If anyone's listening out there, hopefully, they can go watch this video because this might not make sense. But I'm when I'm taking my practice swings, rather than just trying to take a practice swing feeling the shot, I just start out I need to carry this one 12 yards. And I just start at 5, 7, 10, 11. And I just slowly build to it to where my last practice, and that's the way I've been practicing up this ladder, is just literally going every 2.5 yards. I have hit the best chip shots by a mile of my entire life since doing this. It's literally been comical because it's one of those deals. Once you start saying I've been hitting great chip shots, now kind of the pressure's on to do it. And every single round I've gone out, it's literally been incredible. And it's so much so that I've made a video about this for the Decade app. I almost didn't want to put it in there because I know I've got 5 or 6 senior tour players that are members. And I'm like, I don't want to teach them this. I legitimately at this point feel like I'm teaching my competition something, but just trying to own carrying a shot has been easily the biggest improvement I've ever made in my short game.
That's funny because it's like a mini clocks. I mean, I use the clocks. We always talk about the clock system. Adam and I are proponents of it, but I use it for between 30 to 80 yards and I have those locked in. And last episode, I'm taking some notes here because these are the shots I struggle with. So now I'm thinking, like, I need to get my launch monitor out and start dialing. I actually, other topic, I've been watching what you posted about Joe Mayo and the 11 angle of attack. Like, I'm willing to try anything at this point. So that's a separate topic, but I like the idea.
But so I don't do the clock system. I have one position I own, which for me, it's this feel of taking the club as far back as I can without really breaking my wrist. And I know the wrist are breaking and setting some, but it's just the feel for me.
Yeah, what you feel.
Yep. And when I go with my overlap, a reverse overlapping putter grip and do that and basically feel like I'm just dropping the ball, it is 60 yards every single time. And I can do the same position, but feel like I'm decelling in and it's 55. Same position, but a little bit of effort is 65. So I just own one position rather than like every 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's the decels. Yeah. I need to feel the momentum of the club. So I like to go back shorter and then let the momentum like dictate the distance. Decelling and me do not get along.
Yeah. Again, it's just a different tempo of feel because obviously the lob wedge typically has roughly a smash factor of one. So you're really starting to feel the club head speeds.
Yep.
So that's why I'm honestly like, I'm not that concerned about Q school. While obviously, like, I need to get out and play some, but I'm like, I feel pretty confident I can get my long game in decent enough shape. I definitely need to hit some practice putts. But now with this new short game thing, like I really feel like I can get my game to a pretty high level pretty quickly. And I mean, again, like my scores, I've had my first handicap revision of whatever it was at the start of the month. It was plus 5.7 this year. And I'm just like laughing because I, again, still just really didn't play much golf. I mean, again, I'm not even a member at a country club. Like I don't play golf.
To let everyone, I don't know what it takes because I often hear a lot of people like, oh, I could play on the senior tour. And like, what do you have to do to play on the, to get, how well are you going to have to play in that qualifier?
Oh, I mean, so I think that first stage, if you've got the actual ability to potentially play, I don't necessarily think first stage is that hard to get through. And then final stage, there's only two stages. So first and final, there's only four cards. And then the next 15 historically have been conditional. I don't know what they're going to do with changing that. Because it was five cards and then the next 15 for 20 total. But the conditional only lets you get through. You don't have to do the Thursday pre-qualifying, which is just mandatory if you're going to try to play the tour. You can't play the Thursday qualifier, the Monday qualifier, and then wait another 4 days for the tournament to start on Friday. So again, it literally is the hardest card. I'm the last human on the planet, the PGA Tour wants to get on the Champions Tour because I never paid into the system. And they do have to subsidize the purses every week. So it really is meant to be a retirement perk for Stephen Alker. I mean, the guy made $3.5 million last year. He literally changed his life as a guy who's had tour status and, you know, has been out there, but certainly didn't make gazillions of dollars. That's who it's designed for. They want nothing to do with me getting out there and have set it up accordingly.
How good do you have to be to consider going on to that? What kind of handicap, what kind of scores should you be shooting?
I mean, I'm a plus six right now. I would think that if you gave me a senior tour card, I would think I'd be pretty competitive out there. You know, again, it's hard because the only way that you can really think of these things is in handicaps because just saying a scoring average doesn't really matter. But I mean, literally, I've probably shot under par in 30 of my last 34 tournament rounds. And it's not like I don't think there's any chance I'm guaranteed to make it successfully out there. Again, you got guys like Harrison Fraser that are damn good golfers, played on tour forever, and he's trying. And, you know, he's right around the top 35 keep their cards for the following year, and he's right around that number. So you just see a guy like Bernhard Langer, what he's done out there. I think it's one of the most amazing feats in sports. I mean,
pretty wild.
There's a difference in 50 and 55, but there's a big difference in 50 and 65. I mean,
yeah. Let's say you didn't make it. Are you planning on keeping your amateur status and playing competitively to keep making decade content?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, I'm trying to get much more organized. And it's funny because Ben Haddon, that guy that I was just talking about from Good Good, he just moved down here from Kansas City. And I'm trying to get him and his editor to help me remake all of the decade content because obviously it's a little 6 years old and it's just me voicing over PowerPoints. Like, I really want to make that stuff a little bit more professional. We've partnered with somebody to handle our sales and everything. I mean, my joke that I always say is decades been successful in spite of ourselves, not because of ourselves. And I finally am trying to treat it like a little bit more like a real business. So that way I can just try to turn it off and just go play golf. The best thing I can do for decade is just play good golf. The only problem is I am in this limbo spot where senior amateur golf starts at 55. Senior, you know, like I, it's going to be pretty tough for me to compete with Stuart Hagestad. He's just obviously really, really good.
He is. I watched him grinding as I was walking up to the clubhouse on Sunday night, beaten up. The USGA had a nice reception for us with food and everything and drinks. And I'm like walking up there and I see him, he's grinding on 8-footers on the green while everyone's like partying. I'm like, yeah, and 3 days later he won.
Yeah. I mean, that guy, again, like the USGA, as much as everybody likes to give him a hard time, they can throw a great golf tournament. It is, they do.
It's incredible.
Phenomenal job. And I mean, that's why I texted Stuart, right, you know, the day after he won, just like that puts you in, you know, you're one of the all time great mid-ams at this point with a lot more to come. I mean,
that's his third one, right?
Yeah. What did Nathan win for? I think Nathan won.
I don't know. They actually, as I was driving up to the clubhouse, they had all these like great, not posters, but they were like wooden, you know, whatever, like tournament stuff. And it had all the past champions as you're driving up. Yeah. I'm like, you know, Haggis says, and I'm like, oh God, what am I doing here?
That's the first little part of the drive that starts to get you little chills and everything. When it's like Zalatoris in 2017 at Riviera, it was pretty good. I mean, I've seen it at the other place, but for whatever reason, Riviera is just awesome. You're pulling in and you've got all those old pictures of everybody winning the USAM and everything. It's pretty cool.
So what do you think is like the biggest thing, you know, when you first started doing Decade, you weren't playing as much and then you have been playing a bit more. Like, is there anything you changed your mind on or you got more clarity on? Like, what's like the big thing that you realized when you put your game on the line again more often?
There's nothing that's changed with it because there was no better lesson in applying it than caddying for Zalatoris for those last three, four years as he was an amateur, 2014, 15, 16, 17. And so the clarity as a caddy of like, this is how it works. This is what we're doing and just never deviating. Now, all of a sudden you go to play. And this is actually one thing that I wanted to say to you before the mid-am. Now, as a player, the challenge is you never want to play bad because you're out there in front of people. I mean, like you probably don't have as many haters as I do. You probably don't have any haters, bastard. But when you stick your foot in the water,
I hate you for that.
You're so nice.
Squeaky clean.
You stick your toe in the deep end as much as I do. It's hard because I want to always play well because I don't want to give haters fodder. But like by definition, that's not possible. But it's so hard when it's not going well to just be like, hey, let's just grind out a 72. Like again, like I was pretty proud of myself I did everything awful in the second round of the Texas Open and grinded out a 72. And that was as absolutely good as it was going to possibly get, which is rare. You walk off a course and not think I should have shot lower, but it's just so hard to do all this stuff on your own in real time. Like again, that's not anything that I've felt is new about it, but just by playing more, it really confirms playing patient, disciplined golf to try to shoot your lowest score possible is an absolutely impossible thing to do day in, day out. And that's what made Tiger Tiger. I truly believe that.
Yeah. I mean, there's the theory of it and then there's the practice of it where like, you know, everything before you step into the arena, you know, everything, right? And then you get in there and this is, you know, Adam and I talked about what I went through at the US Mid-Am on the last episode. It's just everything sped up faster. That's always the case. I think any new level of competition, like things just get faster. And then afterwards, you're kind of like,
what just happened?
Yeah. What the hell? Like what just happened? And that I think is like the fascinating thing about golf in general, because I know people listening to this, whatever level they play at, I think that's fascinating to me because it could be in the Saturday morning group with your buddies or trying to compete in a club championship. When you're getting into these uncharted territories, like you have the theory of it beforehand, you're like, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And, you know, maybe all the things that Adam and I talk on the show and the content you've produced. But when you get out there in the battlefield, so to speak, it's like, oh God. Yeah.
And that's why I focus and talk so much about meditation with my players and everything. Cause you've got to recognize like, hey, everything's starting to go pretty fast here and you've got to have a plan for how to combat that. I definitely used to always think, you know, what should I be thinking at any given moment? Like you thought there was something that the best players were thinking about. And it's like, dude, unless you're actively analyzing a shot, your default is nothing. There's nothing to be thinking about. Not like I was wondering, am I supposed to be analyzing the leaderboard, the cut line, the top 25, like all this stuff is just wasted energy. And I don't know that I would have realized how important that was without Stuart Sink buying the app and then winning the first week out with it at Napa and then winning 7 months later. And what they were asking him after a second win, again, the guy didn't win for 12 years on tour. And he said, you know, he's like talking about Decade. And he's like, it takes the mental energy that used to be required to make a decision. It makes it for me, which keeps me fresh. And if there's any one thing that I don't know that I would have thought about, it's just, it's the idea that I don't care if you're freaking out. At least if you can run like the decade script over and over again, you're going to make a good decision. You might be going 1,000 miles an hour inside your head, but it's just picking a good target should not be a problem anymore. And I think that's a big part of the battle, especially, you know, not necessarily a guy like you, but someone who's on the cut line on the Corn Ferry Tour, or they're in 30th with a hole to go and they need to get to top 25. Like, what do I got to do? Like, nothing, man. Just run the script, hit some shots, cross your fingers. You know, that's, there's not much else you really can proactively do.
So is that the biggest challenge then, is turning off your desire to pin hunt? Is that what you're talking about?
I mean, that's exactly it. So David Epstein is the guy that challenged Malcolm Gladwell and got him to actually rethink the 10,000 hour rule and all that stuff. And David saw me speak at Wharton last year, and then he came and spent 2 days with me. And we were having this conversation about like embracing uncertainty and like actually gaining confidence from like, from uncertainty. As bizarre as that sounds, it's like, well, once you recognize I'm not going to have certainty, you can start to gain at least more confidence than your opponent. But the one thing that he said that was brilliant, again, he was an NYU guy just like you, or I guess maybe he was Columbia. Never mind. Not as good as you.
No, better. That's Ivy League.
But he was literally just like, you want to take agency over the outcome. And that's, as a golfer, you want to be able to say like, I hit that shot intentionally to 8 feet, and not just accepting that it's largely variance. Again, the better you are, the less variance you need. But it is largely variance. And this is, I got a kid that just graduated. I'm going to try to not say his name, but he just graduated, had got off to a great start from PGA Tour U. And then he's kind of struggled a little bit. And he called me on Friday and he's like, I got to tell you, I just feel like I've got to play more aggressive than decades letting me out here. And I'm just like, well, that's surprising, because I know he's done well. And we just get to talking and he's like, you know what? I actually have not even really been thinking about it for the last week. We've gone from him calling me frustrated because he just made a bad score to miss the cut. And he's like trying to blame anything but himself. Because again, when you're blaming a strategy or your read, or like, you don't feel like you're blaming yourself as much. And I'm like, you just kind of lost your way. And this is why, you know, again, what I told him to do is I want you to sit down and pretend that you're, you know, go back four or five weeks ago when you were playing good and write a journal to yourself. Here's what I'm doing. Here's what I'm thinking. And I try to get players all the time in both good and bad rounds. Journaling is just one of the most standard things I hear from all great athletes saying they do in multiple sports, and reviewing the tape. And that's, reviewing the tape is part of journaling, because you're studying for the future. And you've got to just make some notes to yourself. Here are my swing keys. Here is my process. Here's how I handled adversity. So when I was playing well, I just let it. Well, you didn't just not get pissed. You had to have some way you weren't getting pissed. Maybe you had a song in your head, whatever it was. And then conversely, the flip side is when you play poorly and you do get frustrated out there, why? What was different then? And let's start. What I told this guy to do is like, I want you to write almost a page of just bullet points of what you want to work on, what didn't work this last couple of weeks, and what was working the first 5-6 weeks out of school. And then I want you to literally get to the first tee 3 minutes earlier than you normally would. And I want you to pull it out and I want you to read it. And then I want you on the 10th tee, read it also. And if you find your mind start racing, pull it out and read it. I mean, there's no one you can trust more than yourself. And these are the notes you wish you had. And again, when you get these kids that are under 25 and don't quite have a functioning brain yet from a lack of prefrontal cortex development, you need to have some support systems in place and some ideas that are going to help you be ready for the adversity when it comes, not if it comes.
Yeah, I mean, we love talking about feedback, and there's no better feedback you receive, whether you're an aspiring tour player or, again, a weekend warrior looking to get better. The best feedback is in your round. So a lot of golfers, normal golfers, they just kind of like play and then they forget about all of it. And then we always talk about, like, you know, go back, reviewing shots, what you were thinking about, like all the clues. And that's why you need to play more golf to get better at golf, because all the clues to get better are in your rounds. And it's just like that feedback loop. You need it.
This was not an intentional post this morning on Instagram, but I literally posted something about basically the meditation and having a plan. But I was talking about Tiger. Like, when I used to finish a round of golf and think I should have shot lower when I was playing professionally in my 20s, I would think about all the dumb stuff I did. And then I would just laugh about it and never think, hey, how can you stop doing that next time? Like, it's just, again, I play the smart guy on the internet, but it's like so stupid. Whereas I do believe Tiger, my understanding of how he came up with the Tiger 5 mistakes to avoid that we talk about so much with Decade, which just no bogeys on double bogeys, bogeys on par fives, three putts, blown easy saves, and bogeys with nine iron or less, basically 150 yards and in. But I truly believe that he basically sat down like me after a round of golf. I was like, that was so stupid, but not because I missed the green with the four iron and didn't get him down. Like, what are the real reasons that make me feel like I should have shot lower? And just from journaling and repetitiveness over 5 or 6 months, you're like, these five things keep coming up and I can avoid these five things. It's going to take patience and discipline. Again, you're going to have some three putts. You're going to have some blown easy saves, but like making bogey from inside 150 and doubles for the most part, again, at his level for sure. And bogeys on par five are typically just from trying to force things. And you can just avoid that. It's amazing, honestly, how simple it can be. So like when I'm out there playing, that's essentially all I'm thinking about is trying to avoid those five things. And like I say, it's worked out to playing pretty good golf without even playing much golf.
Awareness is so key. I think that's where journaling comes in, because obviously the best feedback is on the course, but it's so separated. You know, each shot is so separated by time that it's easy. Even at my level, where I'm very good at identifying patterns, you know, I've played for the last 2 weeks. And I'm like, I'm not just not shooting the same scores. And when I actually go through my form of journaling, I find that, well, actually there's nothing wrong with my strike or direction. It's just, I'm picking sucky clubs and I'm just attacking pins that are on the front, missing just short. And so just understanding that, but you have to keep some form of data for this. Understanding that has allowed me to change my decisions when I come to those front pins. But most players, they don't keep the data and they just need to.
And that's the challenge again, because sitting like meditating, it feels until you get it, it takes like 6 months, a year, something before it'll start to kind of click with you. And so every 10-minute session you do every single day just feels like a total waste of time. Journaling just feels abstract. Like, how's this actually going to make me better? And it's definitely one of those deals you just need to trust it's going to. Again, it's one of the most consistent traits I find with the better players that I work with on the PGA Tour, where they're just, you know, again, even Zalatoris, I've asked him before, like, what do you journal after a bad round? He's like, honestly, I'll sit down and just write for 30 minutes about everything I've got to be grateful for. Just gratitude journaling. He's like, pretty hard to be pissed off after you've just written literally for 30 minutes everything that's great in your life. And then it just washes it out of you. I'm like, again, that's easy to say. And it's, how should it be hard to sit down and write for 30 minutes to make yourself feel better? But it's, no one does it except for one of the best players on the planet. I mean, so consistent too that I see that from people.
We are going to take a quick break and we will be right back.
Sweet Spot listeners, we are back with an exclusive offer from one of my favorite clothing brands, Vuori. I've been wearing Vuori for years. I've got their shorts, Sunday joggers, t-shirts, button-downs. I've become a little obsessed with this brand, and I'm pretty sure you are not going to find more comfortable material. I guarantee it. So if you are sick and tired of your old workout gear and you want a new perspective on performance apparel, I recommend checking them out. Everything they make is incredibly versatile. You can run, lift weights, swim, do yoga, even play golf. Or like me, I wear some of their stuff out to dinner for weekend errands or mostly just lounging around the house. So if you want to give Vuori a shot, we are going to give you a 20% off discount off your first purchase, and you're going to get free shipping on anything over $75 with free returns. Go to Vuori.com, that's spelled Vuori.com/sweetspot to get your 20% off coupon. One more time, that's Vuori.com/sweetspot. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you cannot find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to a new perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Also on LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Just recently, they even launched a new feature that helps you write your job description, making the process even easier and quicker. And they know that small business owners like myself and Adam are wearing so many hats and might not have the resources to hire, so it's a great place to get help. Now here's what you can do. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, it's definitely something I do, not just for golf, but in life in general. Is, you know, if you're ever feeling stressed about something, obviously find a problem for that, but then yeah, sit down and say, okay, well, this is going well in my life.
If I could switch gears temporarily here, Scott, I had a question pop up in my head. When I was at Sleepy Hollow, again, one of the awesome receptions the USGA had for us, I was talking with a guy who was following some of my work and yours, and he worked for a course design company. And one of the things that he wanted to learn more about, he's like, I'd love to learn more about like the analytics and the strategy to design courses more effectively. And I know you've spoken to some architects who've reached out to you. So I guess my question to you is like, if you were designing a course, you know, you've poured over so many golf courses over the years and kind of found some formulaic stuff that helped you come up with the system that is Decade. So my question to you is like, how would you design a course to challenge golfers, especially like elite competition, if that's too hard?
The question is, if you want me to just make the hardest course possible, it's going to just be tree lined. I mean, okay, that's it. Yeah. If there's one way to slow down bombers, and it's trees. And that's what's so funny or sad or whatever about all the architecture lovers is they're into tree removal, which I get it. It helps the grass grow, but at some point you've taken out too many and then you complain that guys shoot a billion under on certain courses. But what I really think, like when I start getting confused on a hole, not confused, but like I start finding it interesting, again, this is where it's like blasphemy, I think, in the GCA circles, like Torrey Pines South. It is 18 straight holes of on one side, a bunker starts at 270 and it ends at 310. And on the other side of the fairway, it starts at 290 and it ends at 320. It's like something's in play. So you just, but again, that's where you just send it. But this is where, if the point of a tournament is to find the person that plays best, if you just do the same thing like that over and over and over again, whoever drives it best is probably going to be your winner. And this is where it's so hard, because I do think the game should be about more than driving. But at some point, dude, if you drive it well, it's kind of hard to screw it up. And that's what I'll say about my own game, is I drive it really well typically. And so you're just left with not much. If I were designing a course, it would definitely be something like that at Torrey, something like that with tons of trees. Or what's really hard to do is you want to give people on like a drivable par four, you want to give them two options that mathematically are going to result in the same expected score. So like the green area needs to be making a number like 55 yards wide between like a hazard and some trees, or a hazard and some bunkers, to where like, if you get it up and around the green, and 55 yards is a lot of room, but you're going to miss it a lot more than most people think. But by taking driver, playing aggressively, your expected score is going to be, you know, making it up obviously out of thin air, 3.8. Whereas if I laid up, I could have the fairway a certain width to where I'm going to miss it enough that my expected score. So like I'm trying to give you a layup and a go for it that are going to result in the exact same expected score. That then now it could start becoming the player's decision on, man, I'm feeling it today. I want to try to force something here. But again, I think that's the challenge, is that those questions are not, those answers are not going to be the same for the entire field. So it's going to, like, one player is going to be rewarded off of that design and one player is going to be penalized, and trying to, it's kind of like offering as many dog leg lefts as dog leg rights. So it evens out. You want to be trying to reward some styles of play and penalize other styles of play evenly.
Yeah. Any thoughts on like features in terms of green complexes? Like, I'm just speaking, you know, my anecdotal knowledge of watching golf and playing hard tournaments. Like, I find elevated firm greens with, you know, steep, tight runoffs. Like, I, you know, when you watch those tournaments, you're like, okay, now I can see people like truly separating in approach play, because if you don't hit your mark, then you're in big trouble. Whereas a lot of tour setups, it's just like flat around the green, and it's, you miss it, like, you know, whatever, you got your lob wedge.
Well, from, I mean, from ShotLink, we know that it's, I think it's like 2 or 3 feet. If you're going to be going up or down 2 or 3 feet, which doesn't sound like much, but it really is a decent amount to be below the green level. That's where shots really start becoming harder quickly. The first thing, like an up and down rates, is how short sighted are you? Meaning, are you under this 1-to-1 ratio, 5 yards off the green to a pin that's 5 yards on? That's just kind of a chip shot. And it's amazing how just going from 4 yards off to 7 yards off, if the pin is 5 yards on, how much harder that chip shot starts to get. Same thing happens as you're going below the level of the green. Right around 2 or 3 feet is where the up and down rates, or I should say the proximity rates, which are obviously the same thing, start really getting damaged. So if you're wanting to make it hard, exactly what you're saying is you want to be having some false sides and edges with the green, just Pinehurst. I mean, that's just a, you can get to chipping it back and forth across that green before you know it.
Yeah. And that was on our prior episode when I was preparing for the mid-am, like those were the features of the greens at both courses, elevated. And I was just like, that terrified the hell out of me because my greenside wedges are not where they should be.
But this is where it's so interesting is like, that's for your game. For me, because I've been playing out at PGA Frisco, like the main golf I've been playing all year, they finally opened in May. So like the month of June, I just paid the green fee every single day, 3-4 times a week, and went out there and played in practice. And it is your standard modern width and angles and collection areas. So I literally, and I didn't really realize it again, because I'm an idiot, I hadn't hit a chip shot out of rough in like 8 weeks, because the only place I was playing at was PGA Frisco that has none. And then I get to Firestone and they've got like what to me felt like US Open cabbage. And I'm listening to the other senior like, oh, rough's not that bad this week. I'm like, really? It seems really hard to me. I haven't hit a chip shot out of rough in forever though. So if you put me down there in a little collection area, that's part of the Joe Mayo stuff we were just talking about before we got going. Like, I love that stuff right now. And I have no fear whatsoever of chunking it or anything like that, because I'm using the bounce and the toe well. And this might be something for you. Like, one thing that the better players do, and this is something Zalatoris taught me, but then I even heard Scheffler and Woods talking about it in those little chipping videos that were being released however long ago, is getting the club as upright as physically possible, to where the toe is the only thing that's like touching the ground. So like when I'm chipping off of a real, the tighter the lie gets, the higher the handle gets, and I'm feeling like I'm slapping the bounce of the toe underneath it. And it's because you've got bounce and then it's like a rounded edge. Like it's, I'm not going to say it's impossible to stub it, but it's really difficult to.
I have a friend who is a very good tournament player, very good short game. And he, like a year ago, he was kind of showing me that. And for a while it worked and then I got away from it. But yeah, it's when you feel that, it's nice. I'm not fully done with my tournament season yet, but I'm going to start experimenting on my launch monitor with some of those numbers I saw from TrackMan Maestro.
Dude, I'm telling you, like that's literally the first time, because I've been watching it for like a week as he's been posting all these short game things. And finally I was like, damn it, I got to try that. But I've been trying.
If Adam doesn't know, explain it for everyone what he's been saying. And I want Adam to hear this, to hear his thoughts.
Basically just understanding spin loft and dynamic loft. And because again, like what I posted on Instagram is just like, once you give, that's the one thing I think modern instruction has done so well, like with ball flight laws. Once you tell it like, no, actually for a fade, the face is pointing left of the target and the path is further left. Obviously in a simplified way. Oh, I can do that versus trying to hit these flares. Joe's talking about understanding spin loft. So if we've got a 45 degree dynamic loft and we're hitting down 10 on it, then we've got 55 degrees. Because I've always been like, I don't get how these guys are hitting these low rippers. But just once you kind of understand that, and again, it took a little bit of tinkering around with it. But once I got those numbers up, again, that one that I hit 7 yards, it came off with like 4,200 RPM of spin. I was down 12 on it with like a 26 degree launch. It was just, and again, I'm hitting it off of AstroTurf in here, but it's just a shot I've never would have thought to hit like that before.
Well, the idea seems different because I think, or at least from my understanding, the last 5 or 10 years, when I see a lot of short game instructors, it's talking about like, you know, being shallow and using the bounce. And like he took Hovland, who was admittedly literally the worst chipper slash pitcher on tour, like just dreadfully bad. And he's like, yeah, we're going to get this guy taking divots and hitting 10 down on these. And he's now like brilliant with it. So the Adam, the concept is like these guys are hitting 8 to 12 degrees down on like short, nippy chip shots. Yeah. And if anything,
I'm not taking a divot. Yeah.
Well, some of them are. I mean, I guess the divot could be irrelevant. Yeah, the divot can be misleading. I saw Joe post some stuff about how you can have shaft lean and still be hitting up on it. I know there's exceptions, but...
Well, this is the thing. I mean, as you said, for the last 10 years or so, it's been very, very popular to use the bounce, use the bounce, use the bounce. And
it ain't working for me, so that's why I'm interested. No.
I mean, I have no problem with it. Bounce is good, but I remember a couple of years ago writing bounce is overrated and getting completely ripped for it because it was the trend. Everybody's using the bounce. Everybody's showing, oh, look, I can hit 2 inches behind it and bounce it and still hit a good shot.
I'm just like sculling it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been that type of player. I've always had a lot of forward shaft lean, and I don't dig. Because my hand path works up. And that's a key is the hand path. Yes. The body works up as well, which is what Joe is talking about. So yeah, there are definitely ways of having more forward shaft lean, not digging in much, getting a real steep angle of attack whilst not digging in much as well. I was on the launch monitor yesterday getting like 14, 15 degrees down and just nipping it off the turf. So it's definitely possible. Yeah, as long as that hand path is working up and in, you're golden.
Well, it's like understanding Como's 3D flat spot. I don't know if y'all still talk about that thing anymore.
We're going to get Como on at some point, yeah.
I mean, I went out with him. I actually went to dinner with my wife and some friends, and then we went over to a bar next door and actually ran into Como, who was just out by himself after working with Siwoo. And then the next day I ran into him in the gym. So if you want a connection, I'll definitely hook you up.
All right. I think we covered that question. Another question that I got on Twitter from our buddy Hutch. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this because you've been in high-level coaching for a long time. I mean, his general question is that, you know, we've got launch monitor data, advanced analytics, AI, 3D, all this stuff has been changing coaching and instruction for years. Like, what do you think a golf coach is going to be in 5 to 10 years? Like, do you think the technology is going to like kind of level off? Like, what's your best prediction of how, you know, instructors and coaches are going to be interacting with players?
I'm going to push that one to Adam.
I haven't really thought about it too much. Well, definitely more online, I think. I mean, people are already more comfortable for the last 10 years getting their information on YouTube, which has both benefits and problems. Tiger had a comment on that the other day, right? It's caused a bit of a storm, but I don't necessarily agree with Tiger. You know, there's actually a lot of pushback against Tiger on that comment. So basically, for those listening, he said, stop watching YouTube. You know, there are loads of players who came back and they said, well, actually, I learned a lot on YouTube and I got better from it. And there's definite positives and negatives. I think we've done a whole episode on that, haven't we, John?
Yes, we have.
The challenge is staying true with what you're working on that works. I think that you do get to chasing your tail too much. And I even do it if you could see my list of little swing keys I've got over here in front of my quad for whenever I made a bunch of notes of what I was working on all summer. So it's just over there for whenever I do start playing again. I do think that a lot of players, like, again, I'm 50. I've been playing high level golf for a long time. I kind of know what I'm working on at this point. But I do think that people will be like, well, that worked today. And then the second it doesn't feel good, it's like, well, what's the next one? As opposed to, I tell players a lot of times, like, if you're not playing well, like, maybe it's just not your day that day and you need to go hit the gym and just come back and keep on working on the same stuff that's been working and stop changing directions every single day. I do feel like people do that too much.
Yeah. I mean, in my own game, I have things that I've got something to fix fat shots, something to fix thin shots, something to fix it if it's going left, something to fix it if it's going right, something to fix it if it's toe, something to fix it if it's heel. Basically, our big three. And both sides of the spectrum, I've got something for each of those. So I do jump around, you know, just depends on which day, what the pattern is, what's the biggest issue. But those six fixes remain pretty constant for me throughout life. But is that how you see it, Scott? Or are you working more on things that are like aesthetics or like body motion? Is it related to something at impact that you're trying to fix? Or
I don't. I don't ever try to. And again, this is maybe I've just been fortunate to be a pretty good ball striker for a long time. I'm really honestly trying to think of the best way to phrase this, because I would say I'm really never considering ball flight. Like, I'm just always doing the same thing over and, like, again, I'm Mr. Hit the same shot over and over and over again. And like, that's when I have, not to get on the one shot shape thing, but that's when I do laugh when people, you know, tell me you can't be good at this. I'm like, again, I'm not going to drop that I'm a plus 5.7 again, but I'm a plus 5.7 handicap. I rarely play and I have not hit a single draw on purpose this year. I mean, I'm extraordinarily one-dimensional, and I've challenged the 99% of the listeners to beat that. Like, once you're just doing the same thing over and over again, I'm just working on the same thing all day. My main thing is I'll get to swing off the ball too much, and I'll kind of early extend. So for me, I'm just always working on staying on top of it and keeping my spine angle as good as I can and rotating to where I feel like I'm kind of throwing an underhand pitch.
How do you know when you're doing that? So swaying off the ball, what's your feedback that says, oh, I'm doing this again in terms of ball flight?
I'll maybe start hitting a stuck. There's so many words I feel like people are just, oh, you don't get certain. What feels like a stuck flip hook, that's to me whenever I get too far off the ball and then I don't come back at all. And again, I feel like I'm praising Joe Mayo here nonstop, but he had some post forever ago that said, if you're letting your hips get too far away from the target in the backswing or not getting them moving towards the target early enough in the downswing, you're doing it wrong. And so I literally, like at the State Open when I played well, I mean, I literally was thinking, Joe Mayo, the hips. I definitely do better if I've just got like some swing keys with my lower body and then everything else just kind of does whatever it's going to do. So I usually have got some sort of a lower body swing thought.
What would you be doing? Say you turn up on a round of golf, you're warming up and the shanks occur. What would you do?
Oh, I'll shank it for sure.
Yeah, but what would you do to fix it?
I would definitely super focus on the non-early extension. That's my weight gets out to the toe. I mean, again, like a shank literally is my miss, which is hilarious to be like, I'm a good ball striker. And you're like, but I will definitely throw a shank in a couple times a year. And Colin Swatton, of all people, like he and I were speaking at the South Texas PGA, shoot, like in 2020, might've been 2019. And he's giving me, we're in the hallway waiting for our turn. And we've got an orange whip. And I told him, I was like, I kind of feel, you know, like my miss is a shank. And he's like, well, in your backswing, feel like your weight goes to your trail heel. And then just try to get it to your lead heel as quick as you can. Like, you know, like if you can visualize the presser traces kind of going there. And that alone has done everything for me. So I definitely feel like I stayed out too far on my toes. My hips would not do what they're supposed to do, lower body. And so then I would just kind of get stuck and early extend and throw a shank in there.
What about a toe shot then? So you turn up and you're not shanking it, you're hitting it right at the toe.
I haven't hit a ball outside of the sweet spot. It is definitely all moving towards the heel.
Okay, yeah. So that's good. I mean, this is great because it's knowing your patterns and you do have these fixes. You know, you said if you're hitting a flippy hook, yeah, you've got that staying more on the left side. If you've got that heel, you've got the early extension. So you do have, it's more of a mechanical body oriented cue, which I'm fine with, but you have, these are the faults that occur in my game. This is how I fix it. I don't Definitely. Think that players have their own. Like if I ask a mid-level handicap, you know, you're shanking it one day, what are you going to do? And they're like, well, I don't know. And they throw something random that doesn't relate
Drink
to
beer.
It. So, yeah, yeah. So, it's, yeah. It's
that was my old strategy.
Do you ever hit fat shots, thin shots? Have you got a pattern bias there, or are you pretty solid?
I would definitely lean towards thin. Again, that's going back to my elbow surgeries and the elbow pain for however many years. Like, it was in the 2013 first round of the US Mid-Am that I caught a root on the second hole in Birmingham. That's where it all started. In 2013.
Oh, that's terrifying. I was on a route on my first hole too. And Will Noth, who we have to have on the show, he stopped me. He's like, don't, he's like, come out sideways. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I was on a route. It's terrifying.
I didn't know that I was. I was in the rough under a tree and I just went full in like 7 or 8 iron as hard as I could, because it was a bad lie in the rough, and just straight into this route. And it just jammed my right elbow. That's literally where the hole problem started. I mean, that's why I caddied for Zalatoris in 2014 at the Texas Am, was I got a cortisone shot a couple weeks before the tournament, and the guy paralyzed my right hand for a couple days. That's literally the reason I caddied for him, and it started from the US Mid-Am. So then I probably should have done the surgery way back then, but I really was just having so much fun caddying for Will. I didn't want to take any time off from that in the summers. And then once it's like, okay, I'm getting close to turning 50 now, let's go ahead and address it. But, you know, that was one other thing that I was going to say to people, like, just as like a, let's hop on our Tony Robbins thing here for a second, but just like, I'm for sure in the best shape of my life. I'm the strongest by a mile I've ever been in my life at 50. And it's just, I feel like too many people just succumb to like body aches and pains, which again, all I'm sitting here saying is like, my body is kind of screwed right now. I do feel like I've had a lot of problems with long COVID. I definitely feel like I've had an issue with that, not to start a diatribe down that, but I do a DEXA scan every year And from 2020, which is like the high-end body fat deal, from 2021 to 2022, I do them every August, I put on 6 pounds of fat and 4 pounds of muscle. And that was while I was doing all my rehabs and injuries and everything. But over the last 12 months, I've lost 15 pounds of muscle and put on 10 pounds, or excuse me, lost 15 pounds of fat and put on 10 pounds of muscle from 49 to 50. It can be done. And it's just like eating a little bit cleaner and stuff like that. And I definitely feel like that's part of the reason I typically play pretty good golf, is I'm definitely just in the best physical shape of my life. It can be done.
We are huge proponents of taking care of your body. I mean, anecdotally, I lift weights 3 times a week religiously, don't have any aches or pains. I attribute a lot to that. I walk every day with my wife. Like I love that. You know, we've had Mike Carroll on the show a couple of times, and I love what he preaches on social media, Fit for Golf. A lot of people know him, but you know, just following Mike and other people like that, just being like, you could solve a lot of life's issues of aging and losing bone density and all these things by lifting weights and just moving. And it's not that much time. It's not like a crazy amount of effort you have to put in. But as you alluded to earlier, Scott, it's like doing the simple things over and over again. That's the hard part.
This is where now we can get in. Here's our perfect segue into nihilism.
Here we go.
I'm definitely suffer from depression and other stuff. And I'm definitely a big guy like, man, I don't really get the point of life. Like, I'm happy. I'm not suicidal, but like, what's
we're on
the
a
point,
rock
man?
Hurling through this ridiculous universe. Yeah, what are we doing?
Yeah, we're just an accident. Me. But I was listening to this podcast recently. The guy was talking about like, you've got two choices, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. So even if you're right, it does take an hour a day to keep yourself in shape to where you feel better. But it's either put those hours in now, or you're going to have just 10 straight years at the tail end of your life that are probably pretty much guaranteed to suck. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just delaying that out as long as you can gives you that many more opportunities to die in an accident instead of painfully.
It's more, I mean, I'm inspired by both my parents. My parents are in their mid 70s and they were not physically fit in my childhood, but my mother became, she had a strange case. She became a type 1 diabetic when I was in high school. So when she turned 50, her and my father went from like not working out to like weight training, running, like just totally turned, you know, their bodies around. And now in their mid 70s, they're enjoying the fruits of that. Like they could fall and they'll be fine. And you look at them, they look younger, they're active. Mike Carroll does share a lot of this stuff on social media. I love following people like him and other even fitness influencers, because I think it's becoming like cool now to like take care of yourself. Like the younger generation doesn't want to drink alcohol. You're getting 8 hours of sleep and getting your 10,000 steps in. Like it's literally medicine. So I don't think there's anything better you can do for your outlook on life than that.
Yeah. I mean, and again, you know, life's hard, man. And again, I personally dropped over 6% in body fat in 12 months, again, while gaining 10 pounds of muscle. Like I notice again, now I'm an idiot. Like I keep hurting myself because I keep going a little too far with it. But if you can find the middle ground of not being excessive and still doing the work. I mean, my mom's 70, she turned 75 in 2 weeks. She plays pickleball for a couple hours every day. And it's funny because like, mom, I love you. In case you're listening to this, I highly doubt you've made it an hour into this thing. But it's funny to me to listen to her. She's like, oh, I just played bad today. I let my team down. I'm like, you're 75 playing pickleball. Like,
yeah,
what
that's
are you
awesome.
Talking about? You played yeah. bad. But I just love that she's out there trying, doing something. It's better than sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah, I'm trying to get on that balance of, you know, keeping improving whilst at the same time not doing anything to hurt yourself. That's become, as I'm reaching 40 now next year, that's become more on the forefront of my mind. So instead of weight training, going all the way to failure and racking on the weight, I'm lowering the weight, doing more reps, keeping it just a little bit easier. And so, yeah, I'm finding that's a little bit more enjoyable for me. And yeah, I'm not getting as injured as much, which is good. Although I did put my back the other day after I did deadlifts for the first time in like a year. And then next day I put a sock on and I was on the floor blacking out. But
nice.
It's all fine now.
Tim Ferriss just had a guy on his podcast last week named Arthur C. Brooks, who's just a specimen at 60. And he was talking about like he does these things where he puts these bands on his arms and everywhere, like pretty tight where he's like, so it's like a restriction. And apparently like it increases the burn and the effort, but you can do it with like half the weight. So you're saving your joints. I've got naturally a couple of those on the way now from Amazon. We're hopefully they'll be here tomorrow. I'm going to try that this week and see what it's like.
See, I don't get fascinated by all, like, I don't listen or watch the too much stuff in that realm. I just always veer towards, like, what's the most basic thing that I can do? And that to me is, like, I walk 5 times a week, 40 minutes with my wife, and I do 3 full body workouts a week. And then when the off season comes, I'll maybe do some Peloton, like bicycle riding. Like, I guess everyone's different. Like, I found for me, like, that this, the most simple and basic thing is what I can follow through on. And like, I don't get, I've tried some of that. You know, I did P90X years ago. That was fun, but I'm like, what's next? And then I just couldn't sustain it because I'd be like, what's the next thing I'm going to do? So
that's why I never tried CrossFit, because I'm like, that is guaranteed to end in injury.
Yeah. I have a close friend from college who's obsessed with it, and it's really turned his physique around. But it's like, he's like, dude, it's a cult. Like, when you're in, you're in. Like, you're just there, and like, you're trying to do the next thing. And I mean, it sounds like a great, I just couldn't do that with golf. Like, it sounds like a cool community to be a part of.
But there is, I mean, again, there is no generic advice in diet and, you know, health and fitness, but the generic advice of don't drink your calories, move some sort of movement program, limit your sugar as much as you can, and don't eat fried food more than once or twice a week. Like, if you just, that's like the Pareto 80-20 of not being morbidly obese.
And sleep.
Sleep, for sure. Consistently, yeah, that's the one that, like, same time. Again, like, I go to bed at 10 and get up at basically 6:30 or 7. Every
Me
single
too,
day.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't care what your time is, but getting that consistently where your circadian rhythm can be set. Again, I know this is a golf podcast, but I'm pretty proud of what I've accomplished over the last year. And I just want people out there to know, like, you can do it. And again, it's not impossible, you know, and I've got an ex-wife and 2 kids that are 10 and 13 and 2 companies that I run. Like, I've got all the same stuff everybody else does too. But you've got to prioritize that time. Again, like, I've thought about getting that pain of regret or the pain of discipline tattooed on me somewhere, because I've never heard that before, shockingly. I feel like now I've heard it like 10 times since I heard that. But like, you're going to pay one of those 2 pains. Which one do you want it to be?
On that topic, the calories are huge as well. For if you look at the documentaries on blue zones, you know, where people have the highest amount of centenarians, is it?
Yeah,
the calories is a huge thing. So, you know, they all eat about 1800 calories a day, whereas what's the average American is like 3000 calories a day, almost twice. And there's reasons why, in terms of like cell turnover, things like that, where increasing your food amount is going to lead to a shorter life, not only just obesity and all the problems that come with that, but a shorter life as well. I love all that stuff, as you can tell. But yeah, the pain of discipline or the pain of, what was it again? The pain of discipline or the pain of regret?
Pain of discipline or the pain of regret. Oh,
my God, I love them calories. I have to decide between, do I want to live long or do I want another slice of French toast? And I think that French toast wins more often than not.
There's nothing wrong with indulging some. You got to enjoy it, right?
Well, again, the greatest diet advice is very simple. Lean meats, healthy proteins, or excuse me, healthy fats, not too many carbs, definitely not refined carbs, but nobody's going to do it. So that's actually the worst advice. What can you actually do? And it's like, do that again, 80-20, do that most of the time. I do think don't drink calories. Obviously, alcohol's got calories, but don't like drink sugary calories. Certainly, I'm a proponent of don't drink alcohol anyways, because go have a gummy. It's better for you. But just don't waste your calories on sugary drinks. It is my joints literally after when we went out to dinner the other night, I had 2 margaritas, which I haven't had in forever, 2 frozen margaritas at Mi Casino here in Dallas. And my joints were like just so tender, and I could feel my pulse in them 3 hours after I had them. And it's just crazy how just direct the line is to not feeling good.
The best advice I've heard for all that is eat real food, mainly plants, not too much.
Not too much. Yeah, no, exactly. Who was it that said that one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Pollen or something? Pollen?
Yeah.
P-O-L-L-E-N?
Eat food, mostly plants, not too much.
It's great. Simple.
So now we've turned into the life advice podcast. Yeah. Were there any other, I know Scott, you had like a few bullet points of topics.
Pretty much hit them. You know, the only other one that I had up here was Hannah and Frederick from social media. You guys probably know them, Short Game Gains. Hannah, honestly, she's got a great golf swing. She looks like a really good little player, and she struggled at Q School this year. And it's just the same story over and over again. She didn't have a process. She's been getting out there in the first round of most of her tournaments this year and freaking out. And it's like, once you have to formalize and memorialize your process. This is what I do when I play my best. And then great golf should literally feel like Groundhog Day. I mean, again, I do laugh sometimes when I'm, you know, if I'm playing consistently, I've got my little gym here in my house and it's like, okay, grab the 5 pound dumbbells, do some swings, grab the, like, it's the same thing every single day. And it does start to feel like Groundhog Day, but like everybody says, I want consistency. It's like, well, then do you do stuff consistently? Write down what that is and just turn it into part of your DNA. And, you know, if there's any one thing I would love to add to my daily routine, it's just like a 30-minute movement routine of some sort to start the day, you know, rather than just whenever it is I'm getting ready to go play golf or work out. Just, this is just what you do. And again, there's a number of tour players that I've talked to. They're like, oh, I've got, you know, an hour long deal that I do to start the day. And again, it just gets you in the right frame of mind. It just gets everything kicked off the same way. And
well, it's
again,
familiar. I think familiar is like the word that it just feels like, it almost like it feels like home, almost like something so comfortable. It just gets you going.
I mean, absolutely. Again, so that's, I'm sure I've beat meditation to death on your prior podcast with you, but like just having some sort of a formal process where you're recognizing the ruminating thoughts in your mind before they start to spiral out of control, or you just dwell on them for way too long. Again, Sam Harris just got a great way that he says, you know, the amount of damage you can do in a couple milliseconds by not just pausing before you, you know, between thought and action is just, you can change or save your life like you can't even imagine. And so just trying to give people a little bit of clarity on how to use meditation as a practice. And again, that's the best emails I get aren't, oh my God, I dropped my handicap 4 shots. It's, wow, I was really going through some crazy stuff in my life. And what you talk about with meditation made me finally give it a whirl. And I stuck with it for 3 months. And my God, it really helped me get out of this rut that I was in. Like, that's the stuff that I really love helping people do more than anything. And getting to do it at scale through an app or from social media is just amazing.
Sweet. All right. I got some quick questions here. Maybe we'll do some quick hitters. I got a few from Twitter. Hopefully this doesn't take 20 minutes to explain, but the age old, how do you know to send it versus laying up? And I guess that could be a tee shot or par five question, but what's the most basic way you can answer that for a golfer?
The first part of the checklist is it conceivable you'll ever get it putting? So like even number 10 at Riviera, they don't hit that green very often, but they do put it on that little front bulb 10% of the time, making a number. I have no idea if that's accurate or not. It's probably less than that. But if you'll ever get it putting, it's a pretty good indication that a large part of your shot pattern is going to be chipping. And if you can get it chipping, it is such a huge gain versus even just 40 yards out there in the fairway. I mean, it's just amazing. 40 yards in the fairway is 2.6 shots to hole out. You get it up and around the green, you can start denting that so much. 80 yards, 2.75, again, PGA Tour numbers from Mark Brody's book, Every Shot Counts. But the numbers are all just kind of the same. They're just bigger. So if you could get it putting ever, I'm going to be leaning towards sending it. And then the next question is really, and this is player specific, but are there more about 60-ish yards between penalty hazards? If I can ever get it putting and there's 60 yards between penalty hazards, I really don't care what else is out there. I'm sending it. I mean, the hardest part for people to realize is just because you lay up does not mean you get to just place it in the fairway. You know, back to before we started, Adam asked me why I quit Twitter, and it was because of number 3 at Augusta. I got Colt on TV just talking about these guys should just be laying it up to 100 yards. And I'm like, no, they shouldn't. It's at 100 yards, you have to hit it 250, and it's 25 yards between the trees and the bunker. So it's actually the only place you shouldn't hit it.
It actually, like, I finally was there in person and walking that hole. Like, it is tight around that. It's tight. Yeah, like that's actually a scary layup because everything's like feeding over there too.
And so then if you lay it up short, you have to leave it back at like 140 to take the bunkers out of play.
And then you have that horrible green to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not like you get to place it at 130. You're going to have it, if you're trying to hit it to 130, you're going to have it roughly between 125 and 150 because shot patterns are going to be 25 yards deep at a minimum on that shot. Now, do you want to be 150 or 30 yards? I get it. The chip shot's hard. In the final round, when Zalatoris finished second back in 2021, everybody's talking about laying it up on that hole because you're going to have a better look at birdie. I'm like, a look at birdie? The scoring average in the final round was 4.2. Where can I have the best chance of making par? It's just a really hard hole, as crazy as that sounds. And that's the thing that you just see over and over and over again is getting it up and around the green. What's hard is you're like, oh, it's a hard pitch shot. It is. And if you hit a bad pitch shot, that's probably the same as a good shot from back there at 120 or 30. The only difference is you can really put it in some screwy spots from 120 or 30.
In terms of laying ups, you talked about the 60 yards between hazards. You're talking side to side. What about if you're on a par five, second shot, there's water short? What type of considerations are you taking to, or what type of things are you taking into consideration there?
I mean, again, I'm going to need to remove the water hazard the vast majority of the time.
Is there a percentage rule? Like if you can clear it 95% of the time?
Or no, 90? It's probably not as high as you actually. It's funny because as I was saying that, I was like, it's actually probably not as high as people think it is, but it's like 85. You can afford a pretty high penalty rate, 10, 15, maybe a little bit more percent if the rest of your shot pattern is going to be up and around the green. And you know, I talk about winning requires luck all the time. I also believe that sometimes the luck of winning was you just happened to hit a disproportionate, you still hit 60% of the fairways for the week, but you hit 75% on the par fives. That's just the way the deck of cards shuffled, and you just happened to hit the fairways on the par fives. Overall, your average is where it was supposed to be. You just got a little lucky in the par fives because the holes, the only place that I'm really worried about people scoring, and I even hate saying this because I don't want people then when they don't score getting pissed off, but reachable par fives and drivable par fours are so important in scoring, it's ridiculous. You just don't really score on anything else. I mean, even three-shot par fives, they're basically really hard-ish par fours because you got to hit a couple of good shots to get it down there in the fairway. It just, those holes are so important for wins.
And lowering handicaps.
And lowering handicaps. I mean, again, absolutely.
I think always, I've talked about it to death in my book and elsewhere, but one of the big things that the takeaways I got from your work and Mark Brody's work was just that concept of like when you play scared and quote unquote conservative off the tee and you have this mindset that the safe, you have that safe feeling when you take out the iron or the hybrid, like just see, you do not get to place the ball where you want. And that mindset shift, and now me watching hundreds of golfers over the past like 5 or 6, 7 years, watching them hit those irons into the rough or the fairway bunkers. And it's like, well, now you're just 60 yards farther away from the hole dealing with trouble.
Back to DeChambeau, obviously, Zalatoris, the first player I worked with, DeChambeau, the second player I worked with one-on-one back when he's in college. Now he gets out and he's in the 2020 US Open. They're leading into it at Wingfoot. And all Peter Kessler was talking about was no one's going to go for number six. Only an idiot would go for number six. And I got him banned from Twitter because I was like, only an idiot would lay up on six, actually. And he just hammered me with every expletive in the book and actually got himself kicked off Twitter, which was funny.
He's gone at me once before as well. He's gone at a few people.
I think something's not quite right with him, but which I feel sorry for him about. But it was funny watching the images there because I'm like, this is the way it's going to work. I agree, not everybody's going to go for it. But in the first round, let's make up a number. 50 guys are going to lay up and 50 are going to go for it. Well, of the 50 that laid up, I bet you 15 of them at least are going to miss the fairway. The next day, those 15 are going to send it. The 35 are still going to lay up again because they got confirmation bias. Oh, that was the right play. And then out of those 35, 25 of them are going to hit the fairway, and the other 10 in the final round are going to send it. The only people who are going to lay up in the final round are the guys who happen to hit the fairway the first three times. But it is so mathematically clear you are supposed to hit driver on that hole. It's not even funny. So you send it on the holes like this, send it on 10 at Riviera, and then you figure out, okay, how did that go? Because the one thing that people historically have gotten wrong on 10 at Riviera is they'll hit driver up there, and then when the pin's in the back right, so it's if you get long, you're having to hit this flop shot between the two bunkers, and the green's only 9 yards deep over there.
Terrifying shot. It's
a terrifying shot, but also you're doing it wrong. You're supposed to just dump it to the front bulb and try to two-putt it from 60 yards. That's where you have to have the situational awareness and self-control to be like, okay, I was aggressive off the tee. It didn't work out. How can I get out of here with a 4.2 scoring average? I'm not even saying, how can I just make par? How can I make 4.2 overall? And that's, it's usually not that hard to dump it onto that front bulb and then try to two putt it, which again, you're going to three putt it 20% of the time, which is where I come up with that scoring average. It's guys that go long and dump it in the bunker and then dump it in the front bunker and just go back and forth and make triple, where it's like, that's the wrong way to do it, quite obviously.
Here's another question we got, something we probably covered in other episodes, but I think worth repeating. So let's say you have a preferred shot shape, you're a drawer or fader of the ball, and then the hole is just not giving you that option. Maybe a tree, dog leg. You just lay up shorter, take the shorter club.
Hit a different club.
Yeah, and not try and force it at all.
100%.
Yeah, it just, it always seems like people look at a hole and they're trying to fit a, what is it, the circle into the square peg. What metaphor am I looking for here?
One thing I did learn this year, going back to the question earlier, was anything I've learned or changed. One thing I did learn from Sasho is that on these modern drivers with these huge heads, the further the center of mass is off the shaft, the harder the club is to draw. And I just thought that guys like me, DJ Brooks, yes, I just whipped myself in the same conversation with them.
Guys the holy trinity.
Exactly. Drivers. Guys that hit it hard do tend to fade it. Bryson draws it, but he does it with this ridiculously weak grip where he's literally feels like he's trying to duck hook it because his joints are at the end range of motion. He can't. But for the most part, guys that hit it hard do fade it. And so I do believe that fading the driver is the best way to go about it. Now, I really hesitate saying that because I don't want people who draw it well to try to change to it. But as a guy who fades the driver, it's easy for me to take a 3-wood and move it back in my stance. Or obviously I am the captain of team mini driver. I have this mini driver, you put it back in your stance. So now you're not changing your swing, but you are changing your path simply by ball position. Driver, because of a lack of loft, you can't move around very much. But then this is something that I'd never thought of before. And they had Scheffler at the Masters saying, you know, why are you dropping back to 3-wood on 10 and not just drawing driver? And he's like, you know, if I try to draw driver, it just comes out with too little spin and it falls out of the sky. Like I hit my 3-wood as far as my drawing driver. And I'd never thought of it this way. The driver's the only club in the bag that we do fit for a shape. Like where people used to think that like, well, we can draw a driver and because it's going to have top spin and roll out. Like that's how dumb we were back in the day. We thought that, no, it just had less spin. It was like a draw on average with the same club is going to spin less than a fade. So most people who drew it, it just came off with probably a closer to optimal spin rate. But now with launch monitors and fitting and all this technology, I can hammer a 2100 RPM cut driver just like whoever draws their driver, if it's optimal, it's going to be in that 2100 range. Like that shape has nothing to do with how far you hit it now. But since it's the only club in the bag that's fit for that player's shape, it's not like somebody's hitting all kind of the 9 box drill while fitting a driver. So now if I have it fit at 2200 RPM, if I try to draw it, by definition, it's going to drop into the mid-teens. And it's just a knuckleball that could go anywhere. The flip side is if I've got a draw and I fit it for that at 21 or 2200, now if that player tries to fade it, it's going to be spinny. I had never thought about that until this year. Obviously, I've been arguing with Finney that's the bane of my existence about one shape with the driver. And it's like, literally, you cannot do it. Like, I've been very clear and firm on this, that when the best players on the planet that drive the ball amazing, Keith Mitchell, Zalatoris, Brooks, DJ, all these guys, they do the same thing over and over and over with the driver. And once you are really good at doing that, which again, I'm going to throw myself in that boat. I'm really good at driving the ball. I've got a mini driver that I do draw off the tee and I'm doing that with ball position. So now I've got so much functionality off the tee. It's ridiculous. And the one only other thing about that is people are like, well, then don't you have a huge gap to your 3-iron? I do, because I carry my mini driver about 280 or 285 and my 3-iron's about 235. I'd rather have a huge gap in that region. Maybe there's a par 5 or 2 it kind of sucks on given during the week, but I gain so much functionality off the tee, I'm never dropping all the way back to 3-iron. I'm hitting driver or mini driver on every single hole almost. And once you can do that, dude, the game, I mean, it really does become very simple.
In terms of driving, and I know you talked earlier about how you would design a course and you said having 55 yards between hazards, how often do pros hit outside of that as a percentage, roughly?
80%.
Oh, they hit inside of that.
Inside 80%. Of it, 80%. Yeah.
So they miss that 55-yard range 20% of the time.
A lot.
Yeah, so that's huge for amateurs to know, right?
Shot patterns would blow people's minds how big they are. Again, whether you've got a launch monitor or not, going on into Google Earth or Chrome and just laying out, if you go to my YouTube channel, I'm not trying to pimp YouTube, but if you search NGC, National Golf Coaches Association video on my YouTube channel, you'll find this thing from like 6 or 7 years ago where I'm explaining how to use Google Earth and Chrome, because you could easily draw out these like 50, 60 yard wide grids on your driving range to where you're just practicing. Again, I'm a big proponent of block practicing your driver because I want you doing the exact same thing over and over and over again. I want your orientation to the ball to be just exactly the same. Again, I did that video with Frankie Borelli from the Foreplay Pod. And it was just comical to me watching this guy with his driver. It could be anywhere within like a 6 or an 8 inch circle relative to his body position. And then he'd swing and he'd block one. And I'm like, you know, maybe it's just your ball position. Like your swing might not have been wrong, but the ball position was wrong for that swing. And just owning the ball is the exact same distance from me, the exact same spot in my stance, to where then if I do create the identical swing, it's going to create the identical shot. And that's, again, Keith Mitchell is just one of the best drivers of the planet, the ball on the planet I've worked with for a couple of years now. And that dude just does the exact same thing every single time. Like I'm even fine with people try to flight it down a little bit into the wind. He sends it straight up into the wind with a cut. It doesn't matter what's going on. He is hitting the same shot with the driver. And I just like, that's enough said to me to just be like, it's just what I see so often with the best players in the world. They do the same thing.
But despite that, they still have that wide dispersion. It's just what it is.
It's what it is. But again, but that's the David Epstein thing of embracing uncertainty. Like,
yeah,
okay, I know that. But also like, you know what? It is pretty tight out there. But if I hit a good shot, there's an 80% chance it's going to be fine. Which no, I know sounds I, like awfully yeah. low, but you actually can get like, I'll sit here and flip coins with you for a long time at 80%. It's probably going to work out.
No, I think we've talked about so many times, but when I first started working with the SkyTrack and would hit, you know, driver, just really working on my driver and I saw where it was going, it gave me freedom. It actually gave me more freedom on the course being like you said, like this is the expected outcome. If I hit it in the trees, it's not like, oh my God, my swing, like something's very wrong with my swing. I need to do something. It's just like, that was just part of it.
Well, and this is just to show like how mental I am, because we all are at the Texas Open in that first round. Like I really was one of those, I should have been pretty far under par through the first like 10 or 12 holes. And I was like 2 or 3 under. Now in my head, I'm like, you know, there's some holes coming up with some penalty shots. Like, don't screw this up and wind up shooting even today. Like that's literally what I thought. And then it was just like, okay, that's a stupid thought. Let's recognize that and set it down. And let's just really start investing in the process. Cause like I say, there are a couple tee shots, 18 specifically, there's a bunker left. There's a lake on the right. It's a reachable par 5, but you need to keep it in about a 27 ish yard wide thing and send it. And I just literally dug as deep as I could. And I lined my body lines up right into the bunker. And I was like, hit this thing as hard as you possibly can. And I shipped it just right down the middle. And so the point is I birdied, instead of like being negative and don't screw this up, I birdied 3 of the last 4 holes to shoot 64, but I did it entirely by driving the ball well. I'm trying to figure out how to say it without talking out of both sides of my mouth. You can get so confident by not knowing where it's going, but you then still have to dig deep and just trust that, because I didn't want to put in that bunker and right in the lip and hack it out and have a 4 iron. And still, I didn't want to flare it into the water. Like all those thoughts went through my mind. Every single one of those thoughts went through my mind. But I was just like, dig deep. What do I say to myself on the range? Okay, I've got my spot. I've got my body lines. Turn the brain off and swing as hard as you possibly can at it, just like I would on the range. It's hard to do, but it can be done.
Two things can be true at the same time. A hard thing to accept in life.
In terms of embracing uncertainty, Scott, I don't know if you saw, because you're not on Twitter anymore, but I did post it a little bit on Instagram as well. I had my first viral tweet. John would be proud. I did a visual. Now, I've talked about this in blogs, but I showed how offline a shot would go for a given club face presentation. Now, I've talked about the numbers lots of times, but actually posting the pictures. So I showed what a square club face is. And then I showed what 1 degree closed is. And I said this would go 6 yards offline with a 7-iron at 170 yards. Then I showed 2 degrees offline. This is going 12 yards offline. You're going to miss a lot of greens with this. Then I showed 3 degrees offline, which is not like this, by the way. It's barely noticeable.
It's like 11:58 on the clock or something, isn't it? It's 2 minutes
for every degree.
On a clock.
It's even less than that. I think it's for every minute. Is 6 degrees or something like that. Something crazy.
Sounds about right. Yeah. I mean, if it's 360 around, yeah, it's insane.
Yeah. So then I posted the side-by-side of the birdie chance versus the one that's going in the water. And they just, it's so hard to see. You have to physically look, really look in at it. And so that gives people actually the real understanding of when you hit a bad shot, this is what's changed. It's nothing. It's nothing
it's
at all.
It's just nothing.
Yeah, same with a driver to miss that 55-yard circle, or say you put a 60-yard circle, to go outside of 30 yards offline from your center only requires less than 3 degrees of club face error. So 3 degrees either side and you're going 40. That's an 80-yard circle. 3 degrees left, 3 degrees right, 80-yard circle with a driver at 250.
The key to all of this, in my opinion, again, back to shaping the driver one direction, as long as it's going the direction I intended it to, I got like 70 yards to work with. Like it's a huge area. But once I start double crossing it at all, so now if I'm going to try to draw it, I'm going to start it further right and my miss is a block cut 20-25% of the time. Those are always off the planet. You know, that's going to turn your shot pattern into literally 100 yards wide. And that's the thing that, again, I just know that is such, it's a fact. And I can't believe that I have to argue this. All you have to do is turn the TV on any given Sunday and you just see Max Homa just like, yeah, it's always a fade. Just every one of these top players, like JT, he works it quite a bit. I think he gets himself in just as much trouble by doing it as it is a net benefit. It's a really difficult game.
Did you talk about this at the Open Forum? I wasn't there, but I know you were talking about one shape versus two shapes. I know there are some arguments for two shape. I mean, we John and I are both stick to your stock shape. We agree in practicing different shapes or having a small amount of practice. So that's probably where we differ from yourself. But what was the Open Forum discussion about?
Well, Como asked me to be on a panel where I was going to debate Marty Jurtson, who's a great player. He's one of the lead engineers at Ping.
Yeah, we've had Marty on the show a couple of times.
Yeah, Como was going to moderate Marty and I debating Marty's straight shots and me shaping it. And we show up and we got Finney, who, again, I do not like, and he does not like me. Finney's now moderating it, and now the panel has turned into seven people with, like, Trillium and two more Ping engineers and Nick Clearwater from Golf Tech. And about, you know, I just started off with like a 10-minute diatribe, like I'm sure isn't surprising. And then the first thing the Ping guys said was, well, even in our computer models, the straight ball has a wider shot pattern. And I'm like, what? I don't think that's the way you debate something. You just proved my point for me. And they're like, yeah, but it goes further. And I'm like, I understand the math. You're not going to find anyone on the planet that tells his players to hit it as hard as they possibly can than me. But if a computer even hits it, again, it's not much, but even if a computer hits it less accurate, the shot pattern gets wider. I'm like, there's just no way you can stand on 18 tee at Sawgrass and not know which way the ball is falling. I don't care if it is a fade. I know I'm going to aim at whatever railroad tie it is at 290, and I'm going to hammer a cut off of it, just like I did on 18 at the State Open, aiming it right in the middle of that bunker and hammering a cut off of it. If you're trying to hammer it, aiming 35 yards right of the water, and you don't know which way it's going to go, I do think that's a really difficult way to play golf. And then again, even if the computer models show that the shot pattern gets wider, I'm like, I just feel like that's proving the point. Again, I get it that their strokes gained analysis says, well, it's not so much bigger that it doesn't still yield a positive benefit. But
well, I think there's, you know, there's intention, and then there's also like the psychology of what, you know, what you're talking about. Like there's a human element to it.
I mean, Marty's a great player. He's made the cut in the PGA Championship.
Like, Marty's an exceptional player.
Flat out play golf, which is why I think he's a little lost in the numbers on this one. Again, Marty, if you're listening, it's like I obviously really respect you and your game, and you're way smarter than I am. But, you know, we obviously debated this. Like, I think they're lost in the numbers on that one.
Well, I think it's interesting just because he's an engineer. An engineer is like, I've met enough engineers, like they just view things differently. They see problems and they look at, like, you know,
here is the answer.
Emotion. Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, I think it could be a great mindset on the golf course, but someone like myself, I have the exact opposite type of mind. It makes sense to me in like both directions, like how he can look at that as a math problem, be like, I'm going to solve it this way and do it this way on the course. And Scott, I know you're into math as well, but you're looking at the human element of it as well. And you're saying like, well, I can't play golf that way because I can't step on the tee in the most pressure possible and think that way. It's just not going to get me committed to my shot. And that's probably like splitting the difference.
To that point exactly, and then Adam, whatever you were going to say, but like in this spot, in the most pressure, I want to be able to do what I've done for the prior 71 holes to get me here. So when Zalatoris was in his first playoff at San Diego, he was hitting his driver straight right the entire back nine. And he gets up there on 18 in the on the 72nd hole, and he hits it straight right. But I was watching it at a pizza joint here in town. And again, I've played thousands of rounds with this guy. Like, I know what his body lines look like. I know it's dead calm in San Diego. His body lines were right up the left rough line, and he's just trying to hammer his cut. And I'm like, good, he's committing. Like, he's been hitting it straight right, but he's committing. If you go find the footage then of him in the playoff, he's like 20 degrees further open because he's like, well, if I'm going to spray right, I might as well make it happen. And I'm like, now you're just going to hit it shorter and crookeder. And that's exactly what he did. He basically hit a flary flop shot into the right bunker on 18 there at Torrey Pines. And it's like, sometimes you just got to suck it up and be like, man, I don't really know where it's going, but I'm going to just stick with what got me here, because if we get into the most pressure-packed situation and now all of a sudden we've got to divert because I'm not trusting something, that's flawed in my opinion. What were you going to say, Adam?
So the ping numbers, Marty's numbers based, so he's saying that a straighter shot is going to go farther. Yes, there'll be a slightly bigger spread, but that's offset by the distance gained. Those are based on variance around a given path, right? So it's just a computer simulation. It's not done with actual players, is it? So it's like, okay, if I have a square path and I vary the face 1 degree right, 1 degree left, this will be the variance. If I have a 3 degree in to out path and the variance, same variance around
it, you would just have your standard deviation of what it is, and then you would just run the simulation off of that. I mean, it's the same. Yes, it's just computer modeling.
So yeah, so that's it's not wrong. It's an engineering point of view, but it takes out the human element in terms of, well, if I try to hit it straighter, the act of me trying to hit it straighter as a human brings in psychological uncertainty, which may bring in motor uncertainty. So my motor system might vary a little bit more. What I'm getting at is the way that I personally find out what's best for a player is I test it. I'll ask him to hit fades down there. I'll ask him to hit draws, and I'll ask him to hit intended straight shots. And then we look at what the strokes gained are for that player. And then we also corroborate that with how confident are you with this one as well? Because that's, they've got to take it on the course.
I just don't think there's any way you can do that enough to make it mathematically robust. I know what you're saying, obviously, but I just, man, and this is the problem. I do believe the counterfactual can't be proven. So Scott, I drive the ball really well cutting it only. Maybe I would be better by hitting it straight only, but I would have to go spend 6 months making my swing straight only just to see. Like, I just don't think you can actually prove the counter. And I can't prove the counterfactual to prove I'm correct either. Like, I don't think this is something either side can say, I'm right. Here's my reason why I think I'm right. Here's their reason why they think they're right. But nobody can prove the counterfactual to truly say, I am right for this reason. I don't believe it can be done.
All you could really prove is you could look at the statistics of a player on the course and say, okay, these are, separate them out into, these are when you were trying to hit draws. These are when you're trying to hit fades. These were when you're trying to hit straights. Your straighter shots had better strokes gained. So that's based on past history. Yeah.
So that's Jordan Spieth exactly from my seminar from the 2014 to 2015 season. Remember, at the end of 2014, 2015 was his first Masters. 2014 was when he won the Australian Open and the Australian Masters and the Hero or whatever it was, like, that kind of started getting kickstarted. And that's what that's basically what he and Cameron, my understanding is, they did is they took all of his drives from that year and just sorted them by strokes gained. And most of his worst drives were when he was trying to shape it the other direction. And the quote that's from that article, again, because it's been in my seminar for 7 years now, is, when I looked back, I was trying to work it too much both ways off the tee. And again, he was an interesting guy because he keeps on going in this cycle where you're like, oh, well, that's not working. And then he'll commit to one shape, and then he'll get to playing good, and then he'll go back to trying to work it both. Well, I'm playing good now. I can do everything. And then he'll start playing bad. And it's just like this circle that he's gone through in his career multiple times. I do think you see that. Again, this is with the driver specifically. Irons, because you can vary ball position around, I think you have more leeway at working them. I do still think that most people overdo it. If the reason you're trying to work a club is to get a better look at birdie, I think that's the wrong reason. You let the variance within your shot pattern accomplish that. But if you're trying to shape a ball a different direction to ride the wind to make a club the right club versus, or I don't want to go long, so I'm going to hold it into it or whatever that is, that's different and that's okay. But again, that can be done with ball position, which is a huge difference than with the driver specifically.
Alrighty then.
There was talk of different rollouts as well. This was a tweet that I had. You know, if you're trying to hit a draw versus a fade into a green, there's going to be different rollouts. I personally don't find that. I've tested both. I'm one of those rare people who can hit my fades and my draws about the same tightness. When I'm hitting to a certain yardage, I would hit, say, a drawn 8-iron versus a fade 7. So they end up having the same spin launch, and even though they're different clubs. So the land That's angle and the roll is similar. Yeah, so you can almost throw that out.
The ball has to launch at this angle and this spin to carry that far in this speed. A flary 7-iron is the same thing as a drawing 8-iron. Like, what's the difference? Again, that's Zalatoris on number 15 back at Riviera, the first time he played in a tour event in 2015. Around the middle of 15 fairway, the pin's on the middle right, and he's wanting to like flare a 6-iron in there. And I'm like, dude, just hammer a 7-iron, because he was a draw player at the time. Just hammer a 7-iron right in the middle of the green. And he's like, I got this one. I'm like, okay. And he takes a 6-iron and hits this beautiful shot, just this high flare, lands, trickles out to the dead center of the green. He just looks at me like all cocky, like, take that. And I'm like, that's where I told you to hit a 7-iron. Wouldn't it have been a lot easier to just hit a 7-iron there? And he was like, oh, yeah. Like, I guess it would have. You made that shot way harder than it had to be.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily true that a draw is going to roll out more than a fade. Maybe if you're hitting the same club, but when you're actually, you know, going into a green, into a specific yardage, the draw is going to go longer. So you're using a shorter club. So it's going to have...
Exactly.
I actually get more stopping power sometimes from a draw 8-iron into 170 than I do from a fade 7-iron into 170. I mean, it sometimes stops quicker because I hit it higher with that draw shot.
I don't study enough with the launch monitors and everything to ever succinctly make the argument you're making, but I can assure you I've had that intuitive feel for a long time. Like, what difference does it make? Again, like, the main thing too is like, when people want to draw it to a left pin who typically fade it, it's because, like, let's pretend my 6-iron fade is a 10-yard fade in a perfect shot. And a player will be like, well, I don't want to hit a 10-yard fade to that left pin. Like, the left side of your shot pattern isn't a 10-yard fade. It's kind of a hot pull. Path is far more consistent than face for every player. And so you've just squared the face a little bit more to path than you intended. It's just kind of a pull. It's not that far from the shot you're talking about hitting anyways. Again, I really do believe that with all... And again, I'll throw it one more time. I played to a plus 5.7 this year, and I have not hit a single draw the entire year on purpose, aside from my mini drive, right? To be clear, mini drive.
We're advocates for single shape. You know, I've got like blog simple. Post articles on it as well. I like players to, when I say that I like players to train different shots on the range, I'm not even talking about different shapes, Scott, for the most part. I think it's important, not important, but I think it's okay for a player to be able to hit a draw and a fade, because sometimes you might need it if you got to go around a tree. But like you said, it might be once a round or so. But for the most part, I'm a drawer of the ball. I just want to know, how can I hit more of a push and more of a hook? So I'm staying within those boundaries. It's still the same shape. It's just different variants of that same shape. And the reason why I want players to have that ability is because, say you're having a day where you're hooking it, you need to know what it feels like to present the face more open, to make it less of a hook. That's all. It's not necessarily for hitting different shapes into greens. It's just for being able to control your ball flight and recalibrate it when it's off.
Again, I don't disagree with any of that. But the one thing that I will add to that is, like, well, if I'm in the spot where I've got a tree in my way and I need to hit a draw, like, guess what? Bogey's probably what I'm going to make, and it's probably a good score. Now I can do something really stupid. Again, there are times you just like, this ball has to draw, period. Number 17 at the Cascades here where the Texas Open was, that shot has to draw. I've got my mini driver to do it. But once you're in the trees and you're like, if I'm in the trees, I'm in the right trees. Like, that's just kind of convenient because, like, I can hit my little cut out of there pretty easy. If I'm in the trees in the left rough, it's not good for me. But, you know, Maverick McNealy, that was one thing we talked about his rookie year out on tour, was he was – like, tell me something to work on or something interesting. I was like, honestly, your scoring average from the left rough sucks compared to your scoring average from the right rough. There's nothing I want you to do about that, but I just want you to be aware, when you're in the left rough, this is a bad spot for me. And let's just don't do anything materially stupid from here. I mean, sometimes that's all it takes.
We try and look for the simplest answers all the time. It's easier to play the game that way. I'm with you.
Again, I couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, we covered a lot as usual. We're kind of at our time here. Did you cover everything you wanted to, Scott?
Yeah, I did. I got ankle rehab here in about 30 minutes, so I'm all good with
Okay.
Button her up. Yeah. No, I mean, I just think that, you know, the main thing I always just try to get across to people is you can try to shoot your lowest score and you can have fun while doing it. They're not mutually exclusive. And that's one of the main, you know, negative comments I get is like, well, I'm just out here to try the hero shot and have fun. I'm like, okay, but I have more fun shooting lower scores. Like, sure, there's every once in a while something like, okay, I just want to try this. If there's any one thing I hate about tournament golf, it's the fact that you can't just like, well, I'm going to hit the shot the way I should, but damn it, I want to try it the other way too.
Which you can do in your recreational rounds for sure.
Yeah.
What's your best advice for staying disciplined to that then? So, you know, we have that inner voice of, I want to hit this hero shot. I want to go for that tucked pin that's right just over the bunker on the front of the green. What's your way of staying disciplined?
Just understanding expectations. I mean, again, like decade, the first E of decade is expectations for that reason. Obviously, Lou has done a great job on social media with taking that over with hashtag managing your expectations or whatever his thread that he always has is. But like, just understanding some pretty basic numbers. Just the fact that a 15-foot putt, you know, is 23% on tour. An 8-foot putt is 50-50. Like, it's comical to me to watch people get so mad after missing an 8-foot putt sometimes. And it's like, if we were flipping coins and you guessed heads, it came up tails, you would not get pissed off. You would just be like, okay, and guess again.
Well, it's because in the first situation, they feel like they can control the outcome, or the second situation, they know they can't. That's why golf is maddening.
Again, but if you have me in an indoor putt from 8 feet, I'll never miss it. I will literally never miss a straight, controlled 8-foot putt. And now all of a sudden on tour, you lose half of your expectation. Like, it's not like it's 10% harder. It's 50% harder just by throwing in break, bumps, and wind.
And pressure.
Like, well, yeah, clearly. I'm immune to that. I'm the Iceman.
All right. Well, Scott, working, everyone, we always mention it.
Luckily, at this point, I've hired some good people to handle it for me. So you can just go to decade.golf. It is finally up and running, and you will find everything you need there. Obviously, we've got some great testimonials from guys like Zalatoris and Stuart Sink. And I mean, again, just all these young players that are out there on tour. I've worked with them in some form or fashion. 11 of this year's top 15 from PGA Tour University, half the world top 100 have the app in Wagger. Like, when you see young players crushing it and they seem like they're doing stuff that's wise beyond their years, it's a lot of decade in there. So,
yep. And for everyone else, your Decade Foundations content, I've reviewed it. I always recommend it just for kind of like everyone below the elite level. There's two options. It's a fantastic resource. I point a lot of quote unquote, not elite / average normal players in that direction. Like, you put some awesome content into that too. So I'll always give that a plug. So Decade Golf, decade.golf, right? Yeah.
Don't Google my name. A bunch of bad stuff comes up.
All right, Adam, where can everyone find your stuff?
If you go to adamyoungolf.com/hacks, HACKS, you'll get a free ebook with lots of stuff that we talk about, lots of drills to improve your game. Quick wins. And John, where can people find you?
Go check out The Four Foundations of Golf. It's on Amazon. Just go get it there. As always, thanks to everyone for listening, your feedback, and we will see you very soon with a new episode.
Thanks for having me on, buddy.
Of course.
Thanks for coming on.